This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We're going into uncharted territory that are more analogous to some of the most disruptive events in Earth's history that cause massive warming and sometimes extinction events.
That is our first guest, Drew Crist, about new revelations. Greenland has been ice-free not long ago and could be going there again. Then super scientist Jessica Tierney explains why the worst scenarios for climate change may not happen. Real news, real science, and real climate right here on Radio EcoShock. Everything is changing so fast, but this may be the final straw for me. Even Greenland, frozen Greenland with ice a mile thick, is transitory. It comes and goes. In this second year of the pandemic, scientists discover Greenland was actually green with plants and not that long ago. Is this where this is going? The lead author of the new paper in PNAS is Andrew J. Crist, the Gunn Postdoctoral Fellow and Lecturer in the Department of Geology at the University of Vermont. Andrew Crist, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
There are more twists to this plot than a detective novel, really. We find out Greenland isn't stable. From a drilling core stored in various cold rooms traveling around the world for about 60 years, let's go to the beginning. Who dug up this sample of the real Greenland ground and why?
Okay, so we have to go back to a different time in history, back to the height of the Cold War. And in the 1960s, the most pressing issue for the U.S. military was the threat of nuclear strikes from the Soviet Union. And the most direct route for those nuclear strikes was across the Arctic. And so this caused a large military buildup in the high north, including in Greenland, because Greenland is a Danish territory and was part of NATO. So in the early 60s and late 50s, the U.S. military had built a radar station in northern Greenland. And then they decided that they wanted to learn more about the Greenland ice sheet and whether or not it was feasible for them to hide nuclear weapons inside the ice sheet. And to do this, they needed to study the ice itself and drill ice cores into the ice sheet. Scientists back in the early 60s, early climate scientists, realized that they could look at ice cores to reconstruct changes in past climate on Earth. And so the ice cores themselves back in the 60s were revolutionary for understanding Earth's climate. At the bottom of this ice core that they drilled, which is about a mile long, they recovered about 12 feet of frozen soil at the very bottom of it. And the main focus of those scientists at that time was the ice, not the soil. And so the soil didn't get studied as much. And then the soil was misplaced in freezers over the last 30 years and kind of forgotten about. And so initially it was stored at the University of Buffalo, and then it made its way over to University of Copenhagen in their large ice core storage facility. And a couple of years ago, the curator of that facility, J.P. Stephenson, who's a co-author on our study, was looking through their archives as they were preparing to move to a new facility and found these jars of frozen soil labeled Camp Century subice. And he realized that these were these long-lost samples from the first ice core. That is why how I enter the picture is this, you know, arc of a 60-year story that starts in the fear of nuclear war in the Arctic, and now we're learning about climate change from it.
Fantastic. So was there a particular moment when you realized that Greenland ground was exposed to sunlight not that long ago?
Yes. So after the core samples had been shipped from Copenhagen to the University of Vermont, we received them frozen in the lab, and we weren't expecting to, we knew this was going to be really important data no matter what, because it's so difficult to actually drill through ice sheets and collect soil underneath them. What we did not expect was when we were pulling apart the soil and processing it in our lab in a sink, my co-author and advisor, Paul Bierman, and I are looking at the rinse water in the sink, and we noticed these little black flecks floating around in the water. And Paul jokes around with me. He's like, oh, I wonder what that is. Just like get a pipette and suck it up and then put it under the microscope and see what it is. And then we saw fossil plants. We saw these freeze-dried plants that were from an ancient ecosystem that was on Greenland. And that is the moment that was really exciting as a scientist, because we got to see leftover plant fossils from another time in the geologic past. But that's also the moment that we realized that the ice sheet must have been gone at some point to allow those plants to live and support basically Arctic tundra.
Well, in a 2019 paper, you and your colleague, Paul Bierman, published a paper titled "The Northwestern Greenland Ice Sheet During the Early Pleistocene Was Similar to Today." Would you modify that now?
That paper that we wrote is part of a, you know, like explaining the long-term history of the Greenland ice sheet. And I guess maybe, would it be helpful if we went over like a little bit of just like the broadest geologic history of Greenland, at least in its ice sheet, and maybe that'll help put it in context?
I think so.
Okay. Earth's climate over the last 50 million years or so has been descending into colder and colder states. And around 7 million years ago, the climate had cooled enough for glaciers on Greenland to reach the ocean. So if you think of glaciers like you may have seen in Glacier Bay in Alaska, the ones that can calve icebergs off into a fjord, that started to happen in Greenland. Around 2.6 million years ago, those glaciers got big enough to cover the entire island of Greenland and form what we call an ice sheet, which is a continental-sized glacier. Beginning around 2.6 million years ago, that earlier paper we showed demonstrated that the ice sheet had been more or less present and had already significantly eroded the landscape. Now, what our new paper shows is that even though the ice sheet was there most of the time, there were periods of time where climate was warm enough that parts of it disappeared and potentially the whole thing. So as we, as humans, look towards a potentially much warmer future that could possibly melt the Greenland ice sheet as well as the Antarctic ice sheets, we want to understand what thresholds cause those ice sheets to melt and then raise sea level.
Absolutely. And you found Greenland must have experienced, quote, at least two ice-free warm periods in the past few million years. How could you know that?
We used several lines of evidence to figure that out. And the most obvious one is that when we pulled apart the core and found the plant fossils, that's just the most easily recognizable difference, because right now that part of Greenland is covered in almost a mile of ice. So that is a massive difference. That thick ice sheet had melted away and allowed a tundra ecosystem to live there. Now, the other thing that we did to figure that out is that we looked at the chemistry of the ice that was holding this soil together. And you can look at different forms of oxygen isotopes in water that tell you about past temperature and past elevation. The current elevation of that part of the Greenland ice sheet is around 1,900 meters. And we found results by looking at the oxygen composition of that ice that the elevation must have been much lower and a little bit, and the temperatures were a little bit warmer. So that's another line of evidence. The other way that we figured out, importantly, the timing is that we used a method that involves counting atoms that form when rocks and sediment on Earth's surface are exposed to radiation coming from outer space and through our atmosphere. And by counting those atoms, we can figure out how long ago something was buried beneath an ice sheet, for example. And that method told us that there must have been two different times in the past when this area was free of ice and exposed. Once maybe around 3 million years ago, and another time within the last million years. And then the last way that we figured this out was by using a method that determines the last time something was exposed to actual sunlight. And this method is pretty technical, but the way that you can think about it is that when something becomes buried below Earth's surface and it's no longer exposed to light, radiation, background radiation in soil and rocks, releases ionizing radiation into crystals, and those crystals fill up with really low levels of radiation. It's nothing dangerous, but it's measurable. And then scientists like my colleague Tammy Rittenauer at Utah State goes into a dark room, like a film photography lab, and slowly exposes those sediments to light, and you can measure how much radiation comes out when you basically bleach a sample with sunlight. And so that method is another way that we can tell how long ago something was buried beneath Earth's surface. And that's another way that we determined that the really old event was more than 1.4 million years ago, but less than 3 million years ago.
That's amazing stuff. How have we extended our senses into measuring light from a million years ago or more? It's just amazing that we can do that. I've been looking at a real map of Greenland as it would be without the ice, and the center of the continent is not land, but a massive body of water. If everything melts, would that be the world's largest lake or a new inland sea or what?
Yes, it is a little bit more complicated than that, because what you are looking at is if we just took the ice away immediately, what would actually happen is that the weight of that ice sheet is actually depressing Earth's crust into the upper part of the mantle, kind of like a Tempur-Pedic pillow. When you put your head down on a pillow, it depresses the pillow. But if you remove your head from the pillow, it starts to relax and come back to its original shape. So what we would actually have is, for a while, there would be inundation from the ocean into those low elevation parts. But over time, the Earth's crust would actually raise up and it would become above sea level. That same process has been happening in the Hudson Bay of Canada for the last 10,000 years. It is slowly raising up over time as the crust relaxes from that weight of the ice. But the other big elephant in the room is that you have now melted this massive ice sheet, a frozen store of water, and that will mean that sea level elsewhere around the world is going to be much higher.
I know that the same thing is sort of happening in New England, where glacial memory is causing New England to slowly sink, and sea level rise will seem more pronounced there because of that. So looking back within the last million years, do we know what was growing on Greenland?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because one of the limitations has been that we have this giant ice cap on Greenland, and so it's really hard to find places on Greenland where we have a record of past vegetation, because it's covered in this impenetrable ice. And so these ice cores are really the only way that we can actually get to the bottom of the ice sheet and possibly recover what used to live there. And so about 10 years ago now, over 10 years ago, there is a study from another ice core in southern Greenland called Dye 3. And at the bottom of Dye 3, they recovered ice that was dirty. So it was mostly ice, but it had some silt and sand in it. And it also contained DNA from an ancient forest that used to live in that part of Greenland within the last million years, which was really mind-blowing when that study came out. And then our study, you know, in the northwestern part of Greenland, much further north, we have direct fossil evidence of a tundra ecosystem that used to live there. And so what you might imagine it looks like if you were to go to the high northern parts of Canada today, and you see a landscape covered by small Arctic willows and maybe some small shrubs with ponds dotted across the landscape. And that would be what Greenland probably looked like the last time our study site was free of ice. But there could have been times, and we know there were times in the last million years, where southern Greenland likely had large boreal forests, like in subarctic Canada, that covered the landscape. And that's important to know, because not only will the disappearance of the Greenland ice sheet cause sea level to rise, what grows on Greenland is then going to have a feedback effect or an added-on effect to the global carbon cycle. It changes how much radiation is absorbed from the sun by different types of plants, and that affects the entire global climate system. And it affects how much carbon is exchanged between the ecosystem biosphere and the atmosphere. So understanding what lived on Greenland in the past is not just helpful for thinking about sea level, but it's also important for understanding what our future world could be like if we remove an ice sheet and then have new ecosystems emerge in those areas.
And maybe we could get up there and get some more oil and gas.
That, I know, it's that. I hope that that does not become part of the future, because the other thing about Greenland is that it's an extremely old landmass that has been assembled through many, many different continental collisions through geologic time. And those continental collisions have produced a lot of mineral wealth. And so there is a lot of mining activity that could happen on Greenland, as well as there's some recent studies about mining sand that actually comes from the glaciers themselves, because the glaciers churn up the landscape and produce sand. And behind water, sand is actually one of the most valuable and sought-after materials on the planet, because we use it in everything. For everything that we build involves sand. So it will be interesting to see what happens up there.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Drew Crist, and we're talking about the Greenland ice sheet and the fact that it has disappeared within the last million years. Why in the new PNAS paper do you say the ice sheet was gone within the last million years? Cannot we match this up with other data and get more specific, say the last warming period 125,000 years ago? Why can't we pinpoint it yet?
We have narrowed it down to within the last million years based on the current data we have. We have new data that we have not published yet, and I can't comment on specifically, but we are able to narrow this down a bit. Understanding what happened to ice sheets in the past using geologic history, to me, is like going into a library where a bunch of books have been thrown on the ground and then had all the pages ripped out of them. You can read all those pages and start to tell a story, and if you don't know the page number, you can't put that story in order. And so by each additional study that is done on reconstructing climate in the past, we're able to put a page number on that story, and that helps us tell everything together. In that way, our study we can use to narrow it down and then use other research that's been done using similar methods by counting atoms that form in rocks and sediment exposed to radiation from outer space. And that shows the exact same answer of the ice sheet being gone in the last million years, which is really striking because that study is from the very center of the Greenland ice sheet. That to us, that must mean most of the ice sheet has disappeared. There's also records from sediment that accumulates out in the middle of the deep ocean. And there are many, many different ways that you can reconstruct what climate was like using those archives. You can look at what type of pollen that has been sent airborne and then lands in the ocean. It tells you about what was living on land at that time. And so there is pollen evidence from sediment out in the deep ocean that also shows that there were probably multiple times in the last million years that parts of Greenland were much more green than they are today, and that the ice sheet was possibly smaller. But what our study does that is different than that is that it is actually from the Greenland landmass. It's direct evidence. And so it gives us a firm footing on what that part of Greenland was like in the last million years. And that's really what is the advance that this study provides.
If Greenland can shed its ice, and that would rewrite global coastlines and all the maps of the world, do we have any idea how fast this could happen?
And that is a really intense area of study for climate modelers. Climate modelers are people who use computer models that are complex series of numerical equations to understand how the ice sheet would respond to different warming scenarios under different levels of greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere. There's a range of predicted retreats of the Greenland ice sheet. But there's one study from a couple of years ago in the journal Science Advances that showed that if we as humans continue to release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at an uncontrolled rate, that the entire Greenland ice sheet, which contains over 7 meters of sea level rise equivalent, so over 20 feet, could be gone in the next 1,000 years. I know that you and I will be long gone, but by the time 1,000 years rolls away. But what is important to think about is the path to that. So in the next 80 years, even like a few feet of sea level rise from Greenland, as well as parts of Antarctica, would be really, really devastating to our coastal regions. And we're already seeing the impact of sea level rise on multiple parts of our society. The most direct example of this is in the low-lying island nations of the South Pacific. Many of these nations are being forced out of their historic homes because their islands are literally being swallowed by the sea, and the little amount of groundwater that they have to drink is being salinized by the encroachment of seawater into their aquifers, those people are going to have to leave their homes. And that will, that climate migration and refugee movement is going to be an issue. On top of that, closer to home in the U.S., we see regular flooding of parts of Miami without even storms. There's water bubbling up through the sewer drains there that they have to spend a lot of money to pump back out into the ocean. We see in coastal storms like large hurricanes that sea level rise has exaggerated the impact of storm surge, like during Hurricane Sandy in 2012 that inundated the southern part of Manhattan. And even king tides, which are the highest annual tide of the year, that the added effect of sea level rise causes more coastal flooding. So I lived in Boston for 5 years, and there is a part of the seaport area of Boston that will regularly flood during king tides now. And that didn't used to be how it was. And so all of these impacts have large societal costs, economic costs. They will have political implications. And these are things that we need to really pay attention to, because the coastline determines so much about where humans live and how we behave and who we are as a species.
So sometime in the last million years, Greenland emerged from its ice cover. Obviously, that was a natural event. It wasn't due to humans burning fossil fuels. Do we know what caused such a massive change?
What we are thinking caused this in the past is that there were periods of time in the last million years when Earth's climate was warm enough for a long enough period of time to melt away the whole ice sheet. And so one thing that I should explain is the general history of Earth's climate in the last million years. In the last million years, our climate has fluctuated in these 100,000-year cycles that are determined by the shape of Earth's orbit around the sun. And that kind of paces how our climate behaves. And so every 100,000 years or so, our climate shifts into a warmer period of climate where the ice sheets that cover the northern hemisphere mostly melt away and raise sea level. There are periods of time in the last million years where those warm periods, which typically last about 10,000 years, may have been a little bit longer or a little bit warmer than they are right now. That combination of warm temperatures plus time led to the Greenland ice sheet melting significantly. There's one period of time about 400,000 years ago where we think that large portions of Greenland and possibly parts of Antarctica melted away and raised sea level up to 13 meters higher than present, so that's almost 40 feet. That's one potential candidate for when this happened. So how does that relate to modern climate change? You know, that would be a process that takes thousands of years to melt away the ice sheet. We are looking at a problem where we are melting away potentially these ice sheets in hundreds of years. So that's going to have near-term effects on us and our society. And that's why this is important to understand the natural history versus the human impact.
Once this process starts, do you think it's reversible?
I don't know. I think that there are some elements of our climate system, particularly not in Antarctica, not Greenland, where retreat of the ice sheet could become irreversible. The Greenland ice sheet is sensitive to atmospheric temperature changes more than the Antarctic ice sheet. The Antarctic ice sheet, specifically West Antarctica, is really sensitive to changes in ocean temperature and the ocean shifts in ocean currents caused by shifts in the atmosphere. And that melting of the underside of the Antarctic ice sheet could actually result in a irreversible retreat of that ice sheet. And that is really the scary implication of climate change for the ice sheets, is which ice sheets are going to start melting and will they stop? And so geologists who have worked in Antarctica also are really interested in understanding that record in the past as well.
We have had a flurry of scientific papers and press releases about the weakening of the North Atlantic current that keeps New England reasonably warm and certainly the UK and Northern Europe habitable. It's called AMOC. It may change, and we believe that's because of freshwater coming off Greenland. Does your study have anything to say about that?
The North Atlantic current, or the Gulf Stream, is, as you say, very important for how for keeping parts of the Northern Hemisphere habitable, but it also controls how heat is distributed throughout the ocean. Our study has not, we have not explored the direct implications on the AMOC yet, and that is probably something that as we move along forward that we would do. So I can't comment too much on it, but that we'll see in the future once we get better answers.
Well, Bush's Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld started talking about known unknowns. Given this startling discovery about the fragility of the mighty Greenland glaciers, Drew, how would you prioritize what we need to know?
Oh, that's a great question. I'll just say as a geologist, and so focusing on just what I do, is the thing that we really need to figure out is the exact timing when the ice sheet disappeared in the past, because that exact timing gives us a frame of reference from other geologic evidence of what Earth's climate was like. And that begins to narrow the story, and we can be more confident in what caused the ice sheet to melt away in the past. That, for me, in my research, is the known unknown that I want to figure out, is when was the ice gone in the past? And I guess more broadly, understanding what the rest of the world was like during these periods when the ice sheets were smaller or gone, and thinking about what impact that had on the total climate system. Those are the things that we need to think about at a scholarly level.
You know, I talked to a lot of good scientists on this program, and we learned some frightening risks about the future. But for some reason, your study felt more, well, particularly destabilizing to me, because it's something that I've always counted on. Greenland, ice, mile thick, what could change? So after the thrill of making this discovery, did you also feel a kind of danger revealed in this news?
Yes. The day that we found the fossils was really exciting. And when we first saw them, the first question that we asked was like, well, how old is this stuff? We didn't know if this was 3 million years old or a million years old or even older than that, because it could have been. And so when we started producing the data that told us that it was less than a million years old, it was the day before we had this meeting at the University of Vermont with all the scientists who worked on this project together, and we had just gotten the data back from the particle accelerator that produced the data that told us it was less than a million years old. And I remember being in my office and just like double-checking these numbers, being like, okay, this is confirming a hypothesis that the ice sheet has disappeared in the last million years, and we have really direct evidence of it, and we have the fossils of what was living on the landscape at that time. It's one of those moments where you realize just how sensitive our planet is to relatively minor changes. It's really, really hard for humans alive today to contextualize just how quickly we are changing the planet, but we are doing things in decades that used to take hundreds of thousands of years to occur. And so we are causing a shock to the system that we don't fully understand. And I think that's something that we need to really think about as humans, is what we are doing right now, because it's, as a geologist, we're going into uncharted territory that are more analogous to some of the most disruptive events in Earth's history that cause massive warming and sometimes extinction events. That's the worst possible case scenario. And I don't think that's a foregone conclusion, but you have to appreciate the history of the Earth and contextualize just how much we are changing the natural system right now.
We have been speaking with geomorphologist and climate scientist Dr. Andrew J. Crist. He led the new paper, and the title of it is A Multi-Million-Year-Old Record of Greenland Vegetation and Glacial History Preserved in Sediment Beneath 1.4 Kilometers of Ice at Camp Century. And that was just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Find links to follow up in my blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for sharing this with us, Drew. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your thoughtful questions. Really appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
New climate models suggest Earth could surpass 5 degrees C of global warming, and that would be a disaster for all living things, including humans. But is there a flaw in the latest computer simulations? Our guest, Dr. Jessica Tierney, finds records of past climates suggest we may overestimate possible warming. With her specialty in paleoclimatology and organic geochemistry, Tierney has led or co-authored dozens of peer-reviewed papers explaining how the deep past can help us project the future. From the University of Arizona, Jessica Tierney, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as citizens on this planet, we need to understand what top climate negotiators like John Kerry for the United States will be told by scientists. Where do those climate projections come from?
Well, our projections for future climate all come from state-of-the-art climate models. Climate models are basically giant computer programs that are run on supercomputers. They're computationally very expensive, so it takes a long time to run these projections, so they're run over a series of years in advance of mostly the next IPCC reports, which happen, you know, every 7 years or so, 6 or 7 years. So right now we're about to see the release of the sixth assessment report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's going to be coming out later in 2021. In advance of that, all the modeling groups around the world have been running their latest and greatest climate models to predict how climate will change by the end of the century and beyond.
So these are called the Coupled Model Intercomparison Projects because they run in at least 40 different centers. And we're now on the latest version, which is CMIP-6. And before we get to your objections to the worst-case 5.7 degrees C warming in those new models, I have to advise listeners that the old RCP system, the Representative Concentration Pathways, appears to have been dumped. And that bothers me because the public was barely learning about RCP 8.5, and now that's out. Jessica, what is the new naming system for possible climate outcomes?
So the new outcomes are called the Shared Socioeconomic Pathways, and really they're very much like the RCPs, but there's a lot more scenarios in them. And so one thing to keep in mind about the scenarios is that in addition to a different amount of CO2 emissions or other greenhouse gases, they also make assumptions about how countries interact with each other. For example, if there's international agreement to curtail carbon emissions, or whether some countries decide to burn a lot of fossil fuels while others actually ratchet back. And so there's this huge variety of scenarios, a big menu. But in reality, many of them have a lot of similarities with the RCPs. So in the last round with the RCPs, we had a relatively low emission scenario, which was called RCP 2.6. The numbers on these correspond to the amount of forcing in units of watts per meter squared. So that's like a climate unit of forcing. So how much energy is getting put into the system by, you know, mostly elevated greenhouse gases. So in the last AR cycle, we had these RCPs. 2.6 is the low one. RCP 4.5 is the middle one. And then an RCP 8.5, which was a high emission scenario. And similarly, there are SSP 2.6, SSP 4.5, and SSP 8.5. And for all intents and purposes, they're very similar. There's also some interim SSPs, though, like 7, SSP 7, so in between the 4 and the 8 extremes. And there's also a very low emission scenario, the SSP 1.9, which was designed to assess what would be needed to keep global warming to under 2 degrees Celsius.
Well, I gather the next synthesis report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, as you say, it's not due out till January 2022, but parts of it will be available to governments at the Glasgow COP coming up this December. Will the data given to climate negotiators be too alarming, though, due to possible model errors?
Well, there's nothing inherently, you know, wrong, right or wrong with climate models. I think the big question on our mind right now is this issue of climate sensitivity. So just to back up and explain what that is, climate sensitivity is how sensitive the Earth is to a forced change in climate. So in our case, we're most concerned with greenhouse gases, right? So the more sensitive the Earth is for a given amount of emissions, the bigger of a temperature change you will see. And the units of climate sensitivity are the expected temperature change from a doubling of CO2. So if you were to instantaneously double CO2, how much temperature change would you see on the global level? That's the metric of climate sensitivity. And it really matters because, of course, it determines how much temperature change we'll see by the end of the century or even sooner than that. Climate models each have a different climate sensitivity that sort of emerges from the physics of the climate model. Some of them are not very sensitive, so maybe they have a sensitivity that's closer to 2 degrees per doubling of CO2, and some of them are very sensitive, up towards 5 degrees of doubling of CO2. That would be a high number. So one of the things that has come up with CMIP-6 is some of the latest generations of climate models have a very high sensitivity. That includes some of the major climate models in the United States, such as the National Center for Atmospheric Research, NCARS, TSM model, as well as the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory's model, GFDL NOAA model. Both of them have, their latest versions at least, have very high climate sensitivity, which is, of course, worrying because that means for the same amount of emissions, we see more temperature change. So the question that has been on everyone's mind is, do we trust these models that have really high climate sensitivity, or are they too sensitive? And if they're too sensitive, that means, of course, their predictions are going to be too much climate change, right? Not as much as we'll see. So the question has been, how do we kind of narrow that range of climate sensitivity? After all, what is Earth's climate sensitivity? And that's where my research comes in as a paleoclimatologist.
Well, what happens to the new CMIP-6 models when they try to reconstruct climate during the last glacial maximum just 22,000 years ago?
Right. So that's exactly, you know, what we set out to do in our research was to test these new models against past climates to see if they could reproduce events in Earth history that we have some constraints on. So we took the latest generation of the NCAR model and asked it to simulate the last glacial period, the last ice age in Earth history, which was 20,000 years ago. Sounds like a long time, but for geologists, that's pretty recent. And when we asked it to simulate this ice age, we have a lot of geological constraints on what happened during this cold ice age. The model got way too cold, way too cold, actually. So beyond what any of our geological indicators suggested. So together, our indicators for temperature change during the last ice age suggest that on a global level, it was 6 degrees Celsius colder than pre-industrial. And the model started to predict temperatures that were 11 degrees Celsius lower than pre-industrial. So way too cold. And so that, you know, first order suggests, again, that the model might be too sensitive. In this case, we're going in the other direction. During the last ice age, CO2 was very low. So it was around 180 parts per million. And so we're lowering the CO2 in the model rather than raising it, but it overshot that particular time interval. And so we, you know, published a paper about that just to express concern that, okay, if this model cannot simulate this past climate correctly, maybe it's too sensitive and its climate sensitivity is a little bit too high.
And a wide group of scientists, including Mark D. Zelenka and your whole team, say CMIP models get the glacial past wrong because of assumptions about clouds. Are there strong reasons to focus on the role of clouds?
Yeah, absolutely. So clouds are, you know, a longstanding sort of source of uncertainty in simulating climate changes because clouds act as a feedback on the climate system. So in particular, we're interested in the low clouds. And so when we say low clouds, we mean like stratus clouds. So if you live on the west coast of the United States or Canada, you're used to seeing a lot of low clouds off over the ocean. Those kinds of clouds, these thick low clouds, they reflect sunlight. So the amount of low clouds on planet Earth is actually an important regulator of temperature change because they're reflecting sunlight, so therefore act as sort of essentially regulating how much energy is reaching the Earth's surface. So what happens in these climate simulations of elevated CO2 is that when you increase CO2 in some of these newer models, the clouds, these low clouds disintegrate quite fast. So you quickly remove these low clouds from the climate system, from the mid-latitudes, but also from the high latitudes, and that allows more sunlight in, and it actually acts as a positive feedback, which gives rise to higher climate sensitivity. In the past, actually, some of the older versions of the models didn't have as strong of a cloud feedback, and it might have been a problem. They actually might have been not sensitive enough. And we know that because we've tested some of the older models against ancient warm climates and found that they struggled to simulate the magnitude of temperature change for some of these past or ancient greenhouse climates. But it seems like recently we've kind of gone on the other end of the spectrum now, where the cloud feedback is very strong, which gives rise to this high climate sensitivity. And it's so strong that, you know, you get too much warming or, conversely, for the ice age, too much cooling. Now, so one thing to keep in mind is the climate models that we use for IPCC projections don't actually simulate clouds in of themselves because they're smaller than the grid scale of the model. So the model is broken up into all these little, you know, cubes, and all the physical equations are solved for that cube in the atmosphere or the ocean and so on. Anything that's smaller than that size of that cube needs to be what we call parameterized, which means that you write some physical equations to, you know, essentially represent clouds, but there's no actual clouds in these climate models. So the tricky part is how you write those equations, and there's lots of different choices you can make. And they're all justified because, you know, especially some of these changes in the cloud parameterizations have actually improved the match between the models and observations of clouds from the satellite era. But we're seeing some problems when we take those models and then extrapolate them, right, out to warmer or colder climates.
Yes, we interviewed Tapio Schneider from NASA about cloud formation and the carbon in the atmosphere, and I refer listeners to my EcoShock blog to find a link to that program. You and lead author Zhang Zhu, along with Bleisner and Paulson and others, have been raising this objection about global cooling failure in the latest climate models for at least 3 years. What responses are you getting from the climate modelers about this problem?
Yeah, well, I think there's sort of a little bit of a historical reluctance to trust the paleoclimate record or the past climate records. You know, folks who are developing climate models, they really seek to make sure that the model can reproduce observed climate, and especially satellite era observations, because this is our most complete picture of how the climate system works, right, with clouds and troposphere and stratospheric and everything. And obviously when we go back into geological time, we don't have that kind of resolution or specificity. However, on the flip side, the changes in climate in paleo in the past are huge, right? So 6 degrees Celsius global cooling, that's a huge climate change. And so the signal is large, even though we don't have all the details that you have from the satellite observations. So one of the things that we've been trying to kind of reach out to climate model developers about is that actually, yes, you can use these ancient climates as a way to benchmark your model simulation, because even though we don't have all the details of the climate system back in the past, we do have these massive signals. And when you think about it, you know, what we're trying to do for the future is we're trying to predict climate change under a lot different CO2 than what we've observed over the 20th century, right? So we are going way outside of our historical observations. And so you could argue that in order to really understand what will happen, we need to study ancient climates where we do see these huge changes in CO2 and these huge changes in climate to essentially calibrate our climate models to that. So, you know, what we've been doing is having these conversations with modeler developers and trying to encourage them in the next round of model development, which will be for the, you know, the seventh cycle of the IPCC or CMIP-7, you know, maybe run some paleoclimate simulations out of the box and make sure that your model isn't too sensitive or not sensitive enough. We're at the point where we have enough constraints from the geological record that we can at least benchmark things like global temperature change and even in some cases the patterns of temperature change. So why not use those ancient climates to improve our ability to predict the future?
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is scientist Jessica Tierney from the University of Arizona, and we're looking at ways climate models may influence next steps in the battle against climate change. Jessica, why do scientists assume the same mechanism or formula for global warming works for global cooling?
Well, they're not exactly the same. So when we go back to the last ice age, we have to contend with the fact that there is a giant ice sheet over North America, the Laurentide ice sheet. There's also a huge ice sheet over Eurasia. So some of the climate forcing for the cold climates is coming from the fact that we have these huge ice sheets. They're bright and white, and they reflect sunlight back to space. So that is an additional forcing on top of the changes in greenhouse gases. However, we're able to kind of pull apart the impact of the ice sheet forcing versus the greenhouse gases when we study the ice age. We can pull those things apart in part by conducting simulations where we only have an ice sheet or we only lower the greenhouse gases. And a lot of that, the impact of the ice sheet is sort of on the patterns of change. But ultimately, the response of the climate system to CO2 remains remarkably constant in the last ice age. So when we calculated climate sensitivity of the Earth system for the last ice age in a recent paper, we got a number, 3.5 degrees per doubling of CO2, that is right in the middle of the sort of expected range from the IPCC reports, from the expected range that goes all the way back to Jules Charney in the 70s, which is between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees C per doubling of CO2. So we find that the last ice age is right in the middle of that range. So that tells us that nothing super unusual is going on, and that, in fact, the Earth system is behaving more or less as expected.
Well, I guess what I'm asking, if it takes energy to thaw polar ice, like the Greenland glacier, does that act like a brake on climate change? Does it slow down or almost hide the true energy imbalance we've created with greenhouse gases? And if so, when a lot of polar ice disappears, could Earth then jump up to the real heat we created?
Right. So, yes, the answer is there is this sort of positive feedback, and it goes in both directions. So, on the one hand, if you have a planet with a lot of ice, you reflect a lot of sunlight, a lot of energy coming in, and therefore you have a cooler climate. But once you start to melt the ice and expose darker land, then that darker land will absorb more and more heat, the temperature will increase even more, and you'll melt even more ice. So once you start the process of melting ice, then you have this positive feedback that accelerates the system. And that's why, for example, you know, there's times in the transition from the last ice age into the Holocene, once the ice sheets are gone. Some of those, you know, melting events of the ice sheet happen very quickly. So there are some fits and starts and times and when the ice sheet really drew back, and we see, for example, a big change in sea level that's happening. It's not necessarily a smooth process because of this nonlinear interaction between the receding ice sheet and the amount of energy that the planet can absorb.
Jessica, could you please talk to us about, as you say, the language barrier between climate model and proxy data?
Sure. You think about, you know, how do we know about these ancient climates? We don't have a thermometer, you know, 50 million years ago when, you know, in the Eocene when there's no polar ice and temperatures are so much warmer than today, right? We don't have a thermometer in the last ice age. So how do we figure this out? We have to use what we call climate proxies, and these are stand-ins for things like thermometers, you know, all the instruments that we use today to monitor the climate. We don't have them in the geological past, but we do have physical and chemical and biological things that are preserved in the sedimentary record that record climate changes. So there's a lot of different kinds of proxies out there that we can use to piece together the past. I'm sure that, you know, the listeners are familiar with, for example, tree rings, and that trees change the width of their ring depending on the climate. Sometimes they respond to temperature changes, so they'll grow a fatter ring when it's warmer, and sometimes, like here in the Southwest, they respond to water, and so when it's drier, they'll have a shorter ring. And so that's a simple proxy that we can relate to temperature or precipitation. Going back deeper into geologic times, like my work does, we have to rely on sediment cores that are collected from the ocean and sometimes from lakes on land. And so these are these tubes of mud. But in the mud, there's tons of stuff we can measure to learn about past climate. So an example would be in the ocean, we have these organisms called foraminifera, and they're little single-celled guys that make calcium carbonate shells, chalky shells. And actually, if we measure some of the chemical signatures in that shell, in particular isotopes of oxygen, it's an indicator for the temperature of the water. It can also tell us a little bit about how much ice is present on Earth's surface. And so that's just one example of a proxy. So in my lab, we actually work with molecular fossils. We work with molecules that are left behind and preserved in sediments that come from very specific organisms. For example, we work with one that is a certain kind of fat that's made by a Coccolithophorid algae. And this fat is extremely distinctive, so we know exactly where it's coming from. And it turns out this algae changes the structure of the molecule in response to the temperature of the water. When it's colder, it produces fats with more unsaturations in it. And when it's warmer, it produces fats with less. We can calibrate this today by growing these guys in the lab, by also observing modern sediments. And now we have this powerful paleothermometer. So we have all these chemical tricks that we can do, also biological indicators like pollen, which tell us about changes in the landscape. So that's very important to see how the plants respond to climate change. But the question is, you know, how do we relate that back to climate model simulations? Because a climate model will give you output in units of temperature, precipitation, and wind speed, and so on. And our geological information is in units of, you know, isotopes, trace elements, these changes in these fats. So we have to bridge that gap. And that's done through statistical modeling on one hand, so developing models of how these different types of proxies work, what environmental variables they respond to, and we can test those models in the present day. We can also actually, in using climate models, we can actually simulate a proxy, you know, make a fake proxy or a pseudo proxy from the climate model output. So one example is you can actually put stable isotopes of water into a climate model, and that's very powerful because a lot of our proxies are based on oxygen isotopes, which I mentioned are sensitive to temperature. Also on land can record changes in the water cycle. And we can actually now put those isotopes into the model, so they're already in there, and that really facilitates, you know, comparing two proxies, because then basically you're speaking the same language, a chemical language.
Okay, so your team suggests that we should take past climates, including ice house Earth, into account. Do you or does anyone know how to implement the model changes needed to do that?
Right, so we're coming back to this issue of clouds, and, you know, the question is, what we found is that a lot of the climate sensitivity in these models is related to the strength of the low cloud feedback. In fact, we were able to attribute pretty much all of the mismatch between the latest generation of the NCAR model and the LGM geological evidence to clouds. So that means that's the place to work. And the question is, how strong is the low cloud feedback? If it's not strong enough in your model, then you won't be able, you'll be under-predicting future climate change. Conversely, if it's too strong, you'll be over-predicting. So the challenge is, how do we constrain clouds in the climate model? Now, we don't have geological proxies for clouds. That's pretty tricky. But clouds are closely related to other things in the Earth system. One example would be sea surface temperatures. So as I mentioned, if you live on the California or Oregon coast, you're looking out over the sea and you see all these sort of low clouds. And it's there because the water is cold, right? Now, if that water was much warmer, there wouldn't be as extensive of a low cloud deck. And so it turns out that the surface temperature of the ocean and low cloud cover are very closely related because, of course, the low clouds are going to reinforce cold temperatures. And once they disintegrate, then the sea surface temperatures underneath them will warm up. And so, and we do have geological indicators of sea surface temperatures. That's one of the things that we can do really, really well. It turns out the pattern of climate change is key here. So if you can reconstruct the pattern of past sea surface temperature change, you can link it to clouds. So we're actually, you know, for future work, we're looking into ways that we can do things like, you know, choose geological periods where we have a pretty good idea of the pattern of ocean temperature change. And then what we can do on the model side is we can, you know, change those parameterizations of the clouds, you know, tune them up, tune them down, and run a whole menu of different possibilities. And then we can kind of challenge that menu with the geological evidence of sea surface temperature. So what we think we can do is actually directly use the past climates to constrain cloud parameterizations. And there's a number of groups who are looking into that now. So I think that's pretty exciting work.
Despite your questions of CMIP 6, you are a lead author on the upcoming Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, the sixth assessment report. What is your subject area in that report?
So I'm a lead author on the chapter that focuses on the water cycle, precipitation, evaporation, flooding, and drought. And so we're tasked with assessing anything and everything associated with, you know, rain and lack thereof. It's actually a new chapter for the sixth assessment report. The fifth report didn't have a specific chapter focused on water. But it's a very important chapter because, you know, so far we've been talking about temperature change here. But in fact, changes in rain, changes in drought are a big concern. And I certainly feel that living here in Arizona, where we're constantly worried about not having enough water and how that will change in the future. So it's been a really interesting experience to interrogate, you know, the predictions for the coming century and try and zoom in on some regions and discover, you know, what are the models saying about how the water cycle will change in the future. It's much harder for us to predict changes in the water cycle than temperature overall. But what's really interesting, I think, is that, you know, we are starting to see some convergence between the climate models in terms of their projections. And we're starting to see, as well, some signals emerging in the water cycle. So certain places on planet Earth are getting drier. An example might be the Mediterranean region. And that's starting to come out in the observations. And that's also a place that we expect to get drier based on future climate simulations.
Well, this use of paleo data and climate models is not easy for the public to grasp. And your latest paper, though, does suggest slightly less harsh news about the worst possible outcome for our projected future if cloud modeling has made it too hot. Can we take that as good news?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we think that the models that have, you know, a climate sensitivity that are above 5 are probably just too sensitive. So the projections that from those particular models might be a little bit too hot. Now, it's important to keep in mind that there's still this huge range across the CMIP-6 model group, that some of them, you know, have a lower sensitivity, you know, something closer to 3, middle of the ground. And so those might be, you know, models to look at in more detail and have a little bit more confidence in. But, yeah, I think that we may be able to rule out the most extreme scenarios in the sense that they're based on, you know, associated with high climate sensitivity. But I will say that the biggest uncertainty moving forward is not actually model sensitivity. It's how much humans are going to emit. And that's the first order control. So even if you, you know, ask the CMIP-6 models to, you know, simulate the scenario, there's a range in that scenario. But the bigger range is between the scenarios, right? The difference between SSP 4.5, which is like the middle road one, and SSP 7 or 8.5, which are high emission scenarios, is larger than the spread between the models. So first order, the biggest source of uncertainty is what people are going to do.
We've been speaking with Dr. Jessica Tierney, associate professor at the University of Arizona and a prolific research scientist. Find links to the papers and ideas we just discussed in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jessica, thank you for sharing your work with us. I really appreciate it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Do check out my weekly blog on Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. There's lots of links for you there, free downloads, videos, the works. Please tell everyone about this program. You, as a listener, are the only official outreach agent. Tune in again next week for more great guests. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.